Just a quick reminder, nothing I say today on the podcast should be considered as financial advice. Everything is general or educational in nature, and if you're looking for personalised financial advice, I recommend that you speak to an authorised financial advisor. Just another reminder as well that everything that I do say today is based on my own opinions, and there's definitely no guarantee that my opinions are right or wrong. So you shouldn't run out and do something just because you hear a 37 clip on the podcast. I always recommend people do their own research on stocks. And I guess also is that the information, since it's based on my opinions, that I make the best effort to make sure it's accurate, but it doesn't always guarantee that it is. So always do your own research before investing. The date is Friday, the 24th of August 2018. My name's Jeremy Medlin, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Stock Market Movers podcast. Got a hell of a show for you today. It's been a huge week in the NZX in terms of company updates and things going on. We're going to talk about some ideas for new investors to get into the market. We're going to be talking about Mercury Energy, Comvita, A2 Milk, Fletcher Building, and Spark. And literally, there's been so much happening this week that there's an awful lot that we're going to have to kick the can down to next week's show. So happy listening, and let us know if you've got any questions. I get asked a question every week by investors, and it goes along the lines of, I'm a small investor, how do I get started? Or how do I get started without having much money? And I guess the first thing I'd say is the great thing about an experienced investor or a successful investor is that at some stage they've all had to start small. And they've had to start by buying one share. I mean, Warren Buffett bought his first share. It was only a couple hundred dollars worth when he was 11 years old, as an example. So the first thing I'd say is that the best thing you can do as an investor is start young. And the second thing I'd say is that it's never too late to start. So the great thing about starting young is that I guess mathematically it gives you more time to compound your money over a period of time, but I think it also gives you the best time. It's obviously the best time to learn, but it gives you the most chance to compound that learning, because generally investors age well in the sense that they'll get better as they get older. The second thing is that, and no disrespect to any young people, is that most young people don't have a lot of savings. They don't have much money. And the best time to start any endeavor that is involves some sort of risk of money is when you don't have much. And it means that essentially you'd rather make mistakes with smaller amounts of money than large. So even if you do have a reasonable sum of money, I would still recommend starting in the stock market with a fraction of that. I quite often see people that have been successful in other industries and other professions, or in property or whatever it might be, just jump straight into the stock market with the assumption that that success will translate immediately into stock market success. And no doubt there's been people that have done that and achieved that, but for most people it's unlikely. So I'll give you an example of a true story of a common outcome that I see. And this was a client that came to me when I was working as a broker, and he said, I want to buy some Tesla shares. I said, great, we'll get you an account open and we're away. And he put down $100,000 as his first stock investment in Tesla shares. And Tesla, I'm not sure if any of you are aware, is a very volatile stock, and it quickly lost about 10% over a 2 or 3 day period. The client panicked, sold his shares and lost $10,000. And my bet is that if he had started off with a fraction of that $100,000, so maybe if he started off with a $10,000 investment and Tesla lost 10% in market value, then he'd only be down $1,000, and he probably wouldn't be that stressed out about it. So, but my first advice is, whatever is a large amount of money for you, is start small. And then it comes to the question of what stock do I buy as a new investor? And to be honest, this probably applies to any investor, but I think new investors are led down the wrong path from the first stock that they buy. I see so many new investors buy companies and that they really have no understanding of, or it's in an industry that there's a hot industry and they're probably not good places to start. So an example might be they'll be buying some oil sands company in Canada that they don't really have any comprehension of, or they'll be buying a marijuana stock in the United States, or they'll be buying some cryptocurrency play in Europe or something like that. And I don't typically think that these are good companies to start off with. So I would normally say for new investors, great companies to look at would be companies that they're already familiar with and that they understand. This really would narrow down the universe and help you find the investment. And then, you know, if you stick with some simple quantitative metrics to guide you once you found these companies, is if you stick with a company that doesn't have that much debt, perhaps pays a dividend and has a reliable earnings stream. And finally, if you don't pay too much for that earnings stream, the chances are you'll probably achieve a satisfactory result. And the good thing is that you'll learn a lot on the way that will keep you in the game, because as I said at the start, staying in the game is one of the real keys to success. And the next question is how many shares should I buy? And how many different companies should I buy? And this is a tough one to answer, because it does vary for different people. There are two main principles of this in terms of the diversification question. And I think over the long term, you don't want to be too concentrated. So that's the first principle. You don't want just to have two or three stocks. The reason for that is because if you're wrong on one and they go bankrupt and you've only got two stocks and you've lost 50% of your portfolio, it's simple with mathematics. The other extreme is you don't necessarily want to have 50 stocks. The statistical benefits of diversification really do disappear after about 20 companies. So you don't really want to have 50 stocks. The first reason for that is it will probably cost you a lot more brokerage. And the second reason is you're not going to know as much about your 50th stock as you are about your first favorite stock. And if you do want to achieve that extreme diversification, there's nothing wrong with it. You can do it with one lot of brokerage by buying a fund or an ETF that tracks the index. So there is no right or wrong number in terms of diversification, how many stocks to own. It does depend on the person and the individual and everything like that. But I'd probably say, you know, 8 to 15 will probably work well for most people, but it does depend. There's no right or wrong answer. What I would say, though, is that as a new investor, you probably not going to buy 10 stocks off the bat. That's unlikely. So I'd say for a new investor, the best thing you can do is start off with a small amount of money, focus on one stock that you know and you understand, and buy a small amount of shares. I don't believe in paper trading or anything like that. I think you've really, in this game, you've got to get your feet wet, or else you're not going to learn. So start off with a small amount of money in one stock, and then when you're comfortable with that, you can add to your portfolio with another stock that you understand with a small amount of money. And if you do this over a long period of time, the chances of success are quite high. Now, I think the final thing that new investors should do is find ways to advance their knowledge, so to take their knowledge from 1% to 10% sort of thing. I'm just making up numbers, and I think a really good way of doing that is by reading books. And there's lots of great books out there. One I'd really recommend for new investors is a book called Learn to Earn by Peter Lynch. He's also released another couple of good books as well that I'd recommend. There's a fantastic book called The Essays of Warren Buffett. And what someone has done is they've ordered Warren Buffett's letters to shareholders by topic, and that's a fantastic one for information. And there's some other good books out there. You hear about The Intelligent Investor and Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits, but there is some really good information out there, and the best thing about that is it can really accelerate your learning. So to sort of sum up on new investors, the best thing is it's to start young, and it's never too late to start, is to buy stocks that you understand in small quantities, and to build a portfolio over a long period of time. I think that's about it on new investors. And just sling me an email if you want to have a chat or have any questions about this topic. Mercury Energy updated the market during the week with the headline of Mercury grows earnings and engagement with strong execution. So it's certainly a bold headline. Net profit after tax came in at $234 million. That's up an astonishing 27% on the prior reporting period. It'd be interesting to see if that's sort of a one-off growth or if that's something that can be continued on, because obviously I would doubt that sort of growth can be continued on for a long period of time just based on the nature of their business. That 234 million puts them on about 20 times earnings, which for me, no reflection on the Mercury business is about, it's probably more than what I would want to pay for the business, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And you know, if they keep on growing that 27% a year, I'm sure that will actually look quite cheap. They paid a dividend of 15.1 cents per share through the year, and they've said that in 2019 they're probably going to pay 15.5 cents per share, which puts them on a forward dividend yield of 4.5%. And they talked a lot about brand recognition, and that was an interesting one for me, because you wouldn't think that these energy companies, you know, would have to spend much time on brand and stuff like that. But anecdotally, I've seen a lot of that from Mercury around the place, and I think they have actually done, I would say, compared to the other generators, a pretty good job of the brand recognition and the sponsorships and things like that, and have actually shown some innovation there. One thing I do really like about the company is that, unlike some of the other generators, they haven't diluted their shareholders in any way, and they've actually bought back shares over the course of the year, which in my view isn't something that enough New Zealand companies do. So people quite often get confused with share buybacks because they aren't quite as easy to understand as dividends. But I can explain this in quite a simple way. So imagine there was a company that had 10 shares outstanding and you owned one of them, which would mean that you would own 10% of the company. Now, imagine if the company decided to buy back one of those shares and cancel it. That means there'd be nine shares outstanding. And without doing any work, your ownership has increased in the company by 11%. No, sorry, yeah, it's increased to 11.11%, without having to do anything. So that's what I really like about share buybacks. And of course, your earnings per share is increased by the same percentages as well, because it's the same amount of earnings divided by less shares. So in that last example, imagine the company earned 100 and there was 10 shares. That means it would be $10 a share. But now you've got that same 100 divided by 9 shares, which is $11.11 per share. So it's a good way of companies sending excess cash back to shareholders is buying back shares. And like I said, we don't really see much of it in New Zealand, and that could potentially be because, you know, there isn't as much liquidity in New Zealand as what there is other markets. But I think a lot of New Zealand companies dilute their shareholders. I could go on a big rant about this, but a lot of New Zealand companies slip in a lot of dilution to their shareholders that I don't think is ever good for shareholders. So dilution is something I'm really against. So it is nice to see, especially a big well-known company like Mercury buying back their shares and reducing their share count. Compared to the bold heading by Mercury Energy, the energy from Comvita for its full year result was much more cautious. It read, "Comvita full year result and strategic review." Reading through the update, there's a couple of interesting takeaways from it. I guess the first thing is that, to be honest, that they came across very honest. For me, they outlined the good things and they outlined the issues that are facing the business as well. And you know, businesses always face issues, so most of the time I just ignore these sorts of updates when you don't see any of the problems that the businesses are facing. You know, it's normally quite often glossy prepared remarks from consultants and things like that. That doesn't really give you much of an insight. But Comvita, you know, I think they did a pretty good result, a pretty good, sorry, pretty good job in this report of painting quite an honest picture of how the business is going, and I like that from management. So just going through it, so sales were strong. They increased 19% year on year to about 176 million. And there was a net profit after tax of 8.2 million. Now this decreased from last year, and the company, as I alluded to before, was quite honest about the reasons as to why this was happening. So they said it was their second season of a poor honey harvest, and They also had issues selling their product into China due to some regulatory issues. Now, I don't know, these sorts of businesses, nothing wrong with them. They can be very good companies if bought at the right price. I always have trouble with these sorts of companies that have things happening that are completely out of their control. So the honey harvest, for example, to a large degree is completely out of their control, as is regulatory change in China. Now, they can manage these things, but there's at the end of the day, you can't control the weather, you can't control 100% what happens with these sorts of businesses. Now, the good thing about this sort of thing is that it does provide opportunities, because quite often you see these sorts of stocks and they get completely beaten down due to sentiment from what's happening at the moment, and they don't look too far into the future for potential results. And Comvita did say at the end of the report that they think it's unlikely, given the current, the way the climate and everything is for this year, they see it as unlikely that the next season will be as poor. But again, it is completely out of control, so it is a risk there. They paid a 2 cents per share final dividend. This brought the full year to 6 cents a share, which is a small dividend yield of about 1%. But I guess investors would really be looking forward to seeing how the company deals with hopefully a strong season, and what they can put in place to deal with any seasonality volatility going forward. Shares of A2 Milk up big this week after they released their full year earnings for 2018. They really did hit it out of the park again. These guys, they just keep on getting it done, really. So net profit after tax more than doubled, came in at 195 million New Zealand dollars, and this is on the back of strong sales growth, up 68% year on year to 922 million. So they're getting close to cracking the $1 billion in sales mark. And with nearly 1 billion in sales and nearly 200 million net profit, the net profit margin is 20%. And with a market cap of about 8.7 billion, you're looking at a company that's trading at 40 times earnings. So what we're sort of seeing with A2 is that valuation keeps on coming down as they keep on meeting or exceeding their expectations. So obviously at 40 times earnings, there still is a lot of expectation built into the valuation. So, for this valuation to make sense, they need to keep on doing what they're doing. And I guess the question, if you're investing in this company, is would be your assessment of how long they can keep on getting this done. I was talking to someone during the week about A2 Milk, actually, and it's ironic. I think there is a lot of similarities between what A2 does and what Coca-Cola does. Now, I don't just mean that they both sell liquid drinks to consumers, but more to the point that their business models are actually quite similar. So Coca-Cola itself, right, like A2 Milk, they own all the brands and the intangible assets and everything associated with Coca-Cola, but they subcontract out all the heavy lifting and the difficult parts of the business to other contractors, such as Coca-Cola Enterprises and Coca-Cola Amatil. And what that allows them to do is generate a really high return on their capital employed, because all the capital intensive stuff is done by other companies. And it's similar with A2, for example. A2 subcontracts a lot of the milk production out to companies like Fonterra and Synlait. And milk production over a long term, that's a capital intensive and difficult business. And what that means is that one of the reasons for A2 Milk's growth is that they're able to generate a significant amount on capital employed and reinvest that into the business. So they're not spending a lot on capital expenditures each year. And I think that's been one of the real driving forces between, I guess, the success story of A2 Milk. And like I said before, I guess if you're buying now, you have to make an assessment about how big the market is. But one thing's for sure is that so far they certainly have been able to deliver on that potential. From the sublime to the mediocre, everybody's favourite company, Fletcher Building, reported its earnings during the week. And they reported a net loss of 190 million, and it doesn't look like anyone's going to get a dividend anytime soon. So that's no real surprise to me, really. It's not what I'm talking about. I thought it would be a good opportunity to give my 2 cents on the company. And what I'm about to say is no real reflection on the new CEO and the changes he's made. I think Ross Taylor, the new CEO, has done what he's needed to do all in all by cutting the dividend selling off some non-core assets and shoring up the balance sheet, and probably, I imagine, behind the scenes, banging a few heads together as well, which is, I don't think any shareholder would argue against that. So, but when I look at the problems that have crept into Fletcher Building, it strikes me as an incentive system gone wrong. It seems to be that management at all levels were incentivized and driven to produce growth. And growth for a lot of companies, while it's great, it's not always what you want if it's at any cost. And I get the feeling with Fletcher Building, they're incentivized towards growth at any cost without any profitability checks in place. And it's really easy for a construction company to grow. All you need to, especially a big one, all you need to do is price jobs really low. And if you come in with the lowest price, companies, you're going to get the projects, and that's what happened. But what they found is they weren't able to deliver profitability on these projects because of where they are priced. So it's one to look out for in these sorts of companies is what management incentives are. And another example of an industry where that's quite common is the airline industry. Same thing in the airline industry. It's very easy to grow. You just need to open up some new routes and make them really cheap. But because of the capital intensive nature of the business, it's harder to be profitable. And it's the same thing with Fletcher Building. So that's one to watch out for in the future, investors, is any system where it's incentivised to grow. Now, Atrium Milk, as a comparison, or because it's not a capital intensive business, and the more they sell the better, because like I said, the hard part of the business falls on someone else, you really want to see as much growth as possible. But for companies like Fletcher Building and airlines and other companies, you really want that growth to be sensible. Man, it's been a busy week for earnings. Spark also reported earnings during the week. Their revenue was flat at $3.6 billion, and their net profit after tax was $385 million. I think it's what you'd expect from a big telco and a big player like Spark, really. They keep on doing what they do. I think it's a credit to them, actually, that if you look at telcos internationally, I would say Spark's actually outperformed. And I think, all in all, they've done a pretty good job of staying ahead of the curve in the telco space and staying innovative. And you look at partnerships that they've done with Netflix, for example, and bundling services with Spotify, and then they keep on nipping at Sky's heels with the Rugby World Cup and everything like that. I think, all in all, that they're doing a pretty good job to stay innovative. And it is a space, unfortunately, that I think they will have to stay innovative in. And just a couple of other numbers that were of interest there in their report was that their capital expenditure was $413 million, which is in line with the prior year. And I guess they're targeting, they said, going forward, 11 to 12% of revenues on capital expenditure. And I guess that's where my question mark with Spark is. Yeah, they do a great job and everything like that, but if you're having to spend 10 to 11% of revenue every year just to stand still, just to keep your place in the market, business becomes really tough. So if you think about it, right, you make $400 million in net profit after tax like they did, and then you have to spend another $400 million just to stay still. It is sort of interesting, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of return on the investment they can make from that, because they really do need to make something. And interesting that they noted that they took on, their debt increased by $184 million throughout 2018. And one of the reasons for that was so they could top up the dividend payment, so they could pay a dividend. And I'm probably going to get on my high horse a bit here, but this always makes me a bit red when you hear of companies taking on debt to pay a dividend. And it seems mad to me, really, that if you're running a small business, right, and you'd paid everyone at the end of the year, you wanted to pay yourself a dividend, you're probably unlikely to go down to the bank and take out a loan to do that. And I don't see why it's any different for a large company. Now, I know a lot of investors, especially older investors, maybe might rely on that dividend from Spark, so I sort of get the reasoning there. But it does seem a bit like you're chasing your tail when you're taking out debt to pay a dividend. But I guess that's my own view. Personally, I'd rather keep that money in the bank, maybe pay down some debt so you have less interest payments next year and you're not leveraging the business so much. But, you know, all in all, I think Spark have done a pretty good job in keeping ahead of the curve in the telco space, but it'll be really interesting to see how things play out there, because it is a tough market. And that's about all we have time for this week. Like I said, it's been a huge week on the NZX. There's so much that we didn't even get chance to talk about. Didn't get chance to talk about Air New Zealand, for example, Auckland Airport, Sky TV, Delegates, Vector, and a lot more, not to mention the Tegel takeover saga that's going on as well. So a lot to talk about next week. As always, good luck out there, and send me an email if you've got any questions. See you next week.